You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.
This audio is entitled Evolutionary Spirituality, Part 2, The Dangers of Homeostasis, featuring Andrew Cohen and Ken Wilber.
Well, part of the very delicate balancing act is the traditions have a fund of absolutely invaluable, incredibly precious knowledge and tools for transformation. And again, I try to emphasize that I myself, I'm not saying that any of those are wrong. I'm saying that there are other tools today that need to be added to that.
Yes.
And then when you do that, you do get a little different picture. And the picture is not only here are some tools for transformation that can help your other tools, but that it also gives you an even fuller type of incarnational non-duality, at which in a sense, and I think this is what you were saying, jettisons the lingering perfume of escapism.
Right.
Or mere transcendentalism.
Right.
Or get off the wheel-ism.
Yeah.
That does tend to pervade some of the traditions.
The last time I was in Boulder and I gave a talk at Naropa, everybody was really with me until I started speaking about this evolutionary imperative or this miraculous ecstatic compulsion that comes from emptiness. And when someone asked me, well, was this the same thing as the Bodhisattva vow? I was saying, well, it's a little bit different. And when I was explaining that the evolutionary imperative was really not part of the Buddhist canon, it wasn't, the ideas and notions of evolution were not known at that time.
Right.
A lot of the Buddhists started getting very upset.
Well,
they were with me. They were loving the talk up until then, but at that point they started getting very upset.
Exactly. Well, that's the difficulty. Now, that person, in a sense, was a little bit right when they said, is that like the Bodhisattva vow? It's what I was saying earlier, that the Bodhisattva vow has implicit in it what we're talking about. The previous vow, which was, I vow to get the fuck out of samsara and into nirvana and to hell with everybody in samsara.
Right.
That's your basic transcendental ascending
Right. Nirvana
impulse. The Bodhisattva impulse was, I vow to take nirvana and embrace samsara.
Okay.
And that was
That's the different impulse.
That's a very profound, it was the first real non-dual impulse, and it flowered into tantra, which is that not only will I use samsara as means of liberation, all of the things that you can't use, sex, meat, alcohol, I will use those as means of liberation because all of those can be taken to the path of wisdom. But it also said, even if I'm fully realized, I will still use all those because they are expressions of my own rupakaya. They're expressions of my own self manifesting in the world of form. And I will love the world of form as I would love my own son and daughter because they are productions of myself. So that impulse is there. But they're not living up to it in the modern and postmodern era because they basically made orphans out of these sons and daughters of the modern and postmodern time. They've not taken that world of form into their non-dual embrace. And that's a problem.
Because of lack of understanding or because of laziness and selfishness?
You know, I think both of those are too harsh. I just think it's human nature that when you pioneer an important truth, that you're very reluctant to let go of it, and I think with good reason. It's sort of like the conservative impulse is, if this worked for 2,000 years, don't screw around with it.
Right.
So I think mostly it's really kind of noble impulses of people trying to preserve that which should be preserved, a really extraordinary tradition. But at the same time, there are new truths in the world of form. And if you're really going to be non-dual, you have to embrace those truths as well because they are the present form of your own nirmanakaya, your own manifestation body.
Right.
And they're basically just making orphans of the modern and postmodern nirmanakaya. And frankly, that's not healthy.
Right. So, because so much more is possible.
Yeah, exactly. And again, not taking away
from
the past.
Also, Ken, I also noticed there was a sense that, you know, obviously, whenever one is on a spiritual path, you know, it's obviously to progress on the path, it's essential that one has faith and conviction that one's path is perfect, is whole. Suddenly there was this dawning, well, maybe, maybe there was something left out, even though obviously it was many thousands of years ago.
Yeah, well.
And it was totally understandable. It wasn't taking anything away from anybody.
That's the thing I mostly get. I did an interview with a Shambhala son, and the first question, and the person just came back again and again and again. They looked at a brief history of everything, and they saw the four quadrants. And they saw that Buddha was in the upper left quadrant, not the other ones, you know. So I'm in trouble already, you know.
Yeah.
So I was saying, well, are you saying Buddhism isn't complete or anything?
Yeah, exactly,
and I,
right.
You know, he says, what can you do that Buddha couldn't? And I said, I can drive a Jeep. And it was a flippant point, but it was the point. I mean, you can't find anything about heart surgery in the tantras or the sutras or anything like that. So we really have to adapt to that form. And part of the present-day world of form is we live in an evolutionary universe. That's the part of our own self-knowledge.
Right.
And we have all this extraordinary information and research gained from Western psychology that even if they're living in the world of samsara, they understand the world of samsara much better than somebody who's meditating in a cave.
Right.
So why not combine both of those?
Right. You know, following on from that, what do you this is a question about in terms of spiritual development and evolution that I've noticed. I mean, and I think it's, you know, it's been proven to be true that obviously our natural tendency is homeostasis. The enlightened state, you know, as I understand it, is one where one is, on one hand, one is resting, you know, in the unborn.
Right.
And if one is truly free, one is never moving from that. And at the same time, in the world of time and form, one is, if one is truly liberated, one is ever free from a static relationship to time, as shall we say, in a fundamental way. I mean, you know, maybe one might drink coffee every day or, you know, or prefer rice to noodles every day.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of one's fundamental relationship to time and to change, one's response, if one was truly liberated, would be a consistent, unbroken expression of dynamic freedom in, you know, ultimately, you know, and ideally in all ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one definition of the unenlightened state would be a relationship to time and becoming that was very static. In other words, it seems to be the human tendency to resist, to want to resist change, to want to create the illusion of security in the insecure universe, and to avoid at all costs, you know, having to face into the awesome and unlimited nature of life itself.
Right.
But also what it actually means to live in attunement and at one-ment with the fact that in this world we're living in the universe, everything is changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
That nothing is ever fixed, and in order to be able to respond in the most appropriate and most liberated ways, you know, to that world that's ever changing, in a sense, we have to resist and liberate ourselves from that need to constantly be secure, from that tendency towards homeostasis.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, again, what you're talking about is, in a sense, the paradox of incarnational non-duality.
Yes. Or,
because it is a paradox. And that's what's so astonishing, because on the one hand, there is a realization that you literally are the infinite unborn in every single moment of existence, 24 hours a day in every realm of the universe. That's unshakable, unmoving, unmistakable, undeniable. And you are this embodied, individual, one slice of manifestation looking out on the rest of manifestation.
Right.
And both of those are true.
Right.
And in that world of form, which indeed is unfolding, evolving, constantly in dynamic process, how your individuality then bumps up against the rest of your manifestation becomes very interesting, because that's where this great mysterious process occurs, where on the one hand you are radically liberated in all moments, and on the other hand you have a duty, an obligation to push against those parts of the world that don't share your freedom and fullness.
Right.
And so you are, as you say, there's a almost a kind of a divine obsession
yes.
with, in a sense, tinkering with your own manifestation. And that's the paradox. And holding both of those in mind is difficult for anybody who has a type of non-dual realization, because it's very much like you create this extraordinarily beautiful model, and then you get a hammer and start bashing it because you don't like parts of it. And that's what anybody who's really acting on that implicit bodhisattva vow all the way through the tantric, all the way through the non-dual, is doing. We manifest this extraordinary universe, and then we bitch about parts of it and try to fix it.
Yes.
But that's the game. That's the extraordinary paradox of this thing. I think one of the first things that you do have to do is get that individual vehicle aligned with the rest of the processes of manifestation, and that means a dynamic, constant changing.
That's
and to the
exactly
extent you hold back from that or you recoil from that,
exactly.
you're not standing in the self capital S.
Precisely.
standing in the ego, afraid of this and afraid of that.
Right, that would be the fully, that would be a human life. One was fully embracing the life process then.
Yes.
And, you know, ultimately, completely.
Oh, well, certainly on a good day.
On a good day. Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And because it's definitely, you know, being a teacher with students, it's interesting for me to consistently observe that the tendency of the individual and also of a collective is homeostasis. It's not, and it becomes one thing to get an individual to begin to recognize what's necessary to, you know, the kind of letting go that's necessary
yeah.
to embrace life with yeah. the kind of totality that you know, you were just speaking about. And it's another thing, and it's infinitely more complex, to get a collective to do the same thing. It's almost impossible, but not, I hope not completely.
Well, one of the ways that I would slightly reframe what you're saying is that homeostasis is a strong drive in individuals, but there's also another drive that's equally as strong, and that's eros, or even agape,
right.
the drive that takes you beyond yourself one
right.
way or another.
Right.
And what I hear you saying is that oftentimes you get the expansive drive, and then it's like, okay, I've done enough of,
exactly.
of that. And then
exactly.
it's like, whoa,
exactly.
time to contract.
Exactly.
Get away from me, get away from me, get away from me.
Time to rest and self-satisfaction.
Exactly.
Now,
hey,
now
hey I expanded 2 inches, get the fuck away from me
right,
now.
Exactly. I've done it. And I think, you know, it's hard for many people to realize that, no, the truth is that you'll never have done it. It'll never happen. I mean, not if one is really doing it.
Well, and the whole spiritual process, as you know, it's designed to leave stretch marks all over the ego. I mean, that's rather the point. But it's about as pleasant as childbirth, too.
Right.
I mean, you know, so.
Right. I don't think people are interested in ego death these days.
Oh, why, good heavens, no. That would be marginalizing, cruel, nasty, not honoring the plurality of ultimates.
So, good. So just on this subject of ego, I wanted to ask you about, in the context of the discussion of evolution,
yeah.
I would like to talk about, you know, we're talking about ego, so how we would define what evil is in the context of evolution.
Well, before we talk about evil, we probably...
The reason I'm bringing up because it's obviously a very charged word.
I understand, and as long as we try to understand his meaning,
yeah,
you know, that's okay. But the prior discussion is, what is ego? And
yeah.
I realize that this has been a topic of the magazine in the past, but I still find a lot of the discussion kind of continues to slide around the issue, because there's at least two important definitions of ego, and people seem to kind of confuse them a lot, as far as I can tell. And one is that ego simply means, and this is the way Western psychologists tend to use it, it's simply a functional organization of the psyche for conventional purposes. And so having a strong ego in that sense is not only a good idea,
absolutely
not having
essential.
A strong ego. Huh?
It's essential.
It's absolutely essential, and we define an awful lot of really unpleasant pathological states as basically borderline conditions that don't have enough ego structure
correct.
To organize experience in a meaningful and coherent way.
Correct.
Getting rid of that ego is not enlightenment. That is your worst nightmare.
No, of course.
So that part of it is, I think, very important. But then there's, of course, ego just in a generic sense, meaning a separate self sense.
Right.
And that means not merely that you have an egoic individuality, but that you are exclusively identified with that egoic individuality. Then that's ego in a, quote, evil sense,
okay.
or ego in a bad sense. Most traditions, even the ones that are just ascending, the ones that are non-dual, and the ones that are merely descending, they want to get rid of the separate self sense. That's fine. But what happened when those teachings came into this country is that the whole notion of, quote, no ego had a really damaging effect in the psychological community, because most psychologists and psychiatrists looked at the notion and said, so you're training to be a borderline?
No, but
why?
No, because
what's the fun there, please?
No, because the word, as you clearly explained, the words for two completely, it's to define two completely different functions. And whenever I speak about it, I always make that distinction, because often people don't know what I'm talking about.
No, it's, and that part is, I think, is really important. Then when you get into sort of evil in an evolutionary sense, what
yeah.
does it possibly mean,
yeah.
and so on.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. I tend to think that, again, there are sort of at least two different types of, quote, evil. One is within whatever present stage of evolution or development you're at, you horribly misuse the potentials of that stage, and it usually means with a malevolent intent.
Yeah.
You actually are, you know, just a rotten person, and you delight in seeing other people suffer and so on, and there's a pure kind of, quote, evil in that intent, and it can pretty much strike anybody, anywhere, any level for reasons nobody quite understands. Even fairly highly evolved states have a kind of Darth Vader move that's always possible.
I mean, yeah, definitely, even in quote-unquote enlightened people. Apparently not completely free of that tendency, I guess, or potential.
I think that's right. And again, one of the things that we all sort of agree on is that, you know, enlightenment isn't an all-or-nothing thing. Spirit is. I mean, spirit is 100% there all the time. But our individuality taps into it on, sometimes a more regular, sometimes a less regular basis, if you will. And we're always living up to our potentials and sometimes not living up to them. Or at the very least, sometimes even if we're ensconced in the unborn witness 24 hours a day, sometimes our vehicle still gets really cranky.
And also what can happen is that one way this could happen is that the one who was ensconced in the awakened consciousness could identify with being the one who was awake.
Oh, yeah. Oh, exactly. Exactly.
And then there's the... And I do feel that one of the greatest temptations, which many, realize or succumb to, the greatest temptations of enlightenment itself is to be the only one or that one, because ultimately the realization is there's only one without a second.
Exactly.
And then the next step is, and I am that one without a second. Now, that could be okay, but the thing is one would have to have a tremendous either amount of humility or an unusually pure motivation not to admit that and to draw no conclusions about that on a personal level.
And almost impossible to do that. The difficulty, as you say, is realization does carry an absolutely invincible realization that I am that one and there is one without a second. The problem with that is that one without a second, if you're not really careful, confers a sort of pseudo-invincibility on your finite personality.
Right, exactly, yeah.
You actually think you can do no wrong.
Right.
And you can barely add in some cases or,
right,
read or whatever the problem might be. And so your rupakaya, your world of form, your vehicle, is completely screwed up. But you do have this authority of this transcendental oneness. And it takes an enormous amount of intelligence, wisdom, and courage to be able to handle that without, as you say, equating the two, which is a problem that happens, unfortunately, quite a bit. The second type of, quote, evil in the evolutionary process is you could look at that which at any level actively prevents the emergence of a deeper, higher, wider level.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Could be looked at as, quote, evil.
Bold and beautiful.
And that's one of the things that we obviously have to watch in ourselves all the time. And it's the same principle you just discussed in a different light as homeostasis.
It's yes, yes.
The inability to live up to our own higher self and our own higher potentials. Yes. And basically go through that birthing pain and labor pain without asking for the morphine drip.
that's beautiful, Ken. Fantastic.
All right.
Outrageous. Okay, so now to move on to something that's a little fun. I mean, I'm having a great time. But this is... Just so you know, we're doing, an outrageous piece called In Search of Babaji, which I'm sure you're going to definitely love. And basically...
Well, he's right here on the couch. I'll let you talk.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's here, too. Gee, he's bilocating.
Oh, excellent.
So...
Oh, you've got one of those, too.
So, basically, the reason we wanted to do it was, number one, to have some fun.
Right.
To blow a lot of people's minds. I pop a lot of balloons. I'm sure it's going to upset a lot of people. But anyway, on one hand, Babaji represents, at least to a lot of people, and also theoretically, the highest conceivable form of evolution known to man at the moment in many ways. In other words, he would be an example of perfect ego death, of the highest and deepest purity of motivation. He's living only to help to watch over and further and guide, you know, the evolution of the human race. So he's the ultimate bodhisattva. But even more than that, he's really attained at least what the mother was talking about, because he literally has controls over the cells of his body, because he's immortal and can literally, you know, has absolute control over his physical manifestation, and ultimately has attained the light body. Okay?
Well, that's going to look good on a resume.
So, anyway, it's a really fun piece, and it starts out taking the whole thing very seriously. You know, and I felt it was very important to be very careful with it. And just simply through speaking to different people, the story goes from, you know, trying to take it seriously to it becoming progressively more absurd.
Yeah.
But by itself, so it's done, yeah. I think it's done appropriately. But I think a lot of the people in the yoga scene are going to have a hard time with it, but they're not going to be able to blame us for anything, because we didn't do anything. It's just the facts, ma'am.
Yep.
But what I wanted to ask you about was, in relationship to evolution, was that the light body, you know, a lot of traditions talk about the attainment of the light body.
Right.
You know, obviously the yogic traditions do, the Tibetan tradition has its variations on it,
yeah.
I think the Christian traditions do, etc.
Yeah.
And everybody that I have spoken to about, I mean, not that I spent much time on this myself, but everybody, but people have spoken about, whenever I pressed them, you know, they actually didn't really know what the hell they were talking about.
Right.
And I wonder if anybody really does. So I was wondering if you had any ideas about these ideas of, you know, of such absolute control over the vital,
right,
that one can literally control the cells of one's body and attain the light body, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I think it's usually the case with these issues. There's a grain or several grains of truth in it, and certain fantasies, wishes, hopes, fears that get hung on these things. And I think it's kind of important to try to, you know, be as fair as we can to all of those that go into these notions, such as the light body. On the one hand, there's certain positive things that are behind the notion of a light body, and you sort of need a complicated esoteric psychology and ontology to go into it. The simplest way to go into it is to say that as the Dharmakaya, or emptiness, basically infuses the Rupakaya, or form, with this ecstatic, blissful release, that form itself tends to take on a transparent, luminous quality. And it's another variation on the whole idea of non-duality, that basically things that were thought to be, quote, spiritual and in some other realm up there, in fact, can be present in this concrete body and transfigure it. And there's a lot of truth to that in many ways. And I think we have to honor that truth. On the other hand, it's made to order for egoic fantasies of omnipotence. And yogic traditions are not immune to this. I mean, part of yoga, indeed, was what we call sort of a higher yoga, which is a realization of the transcendental self. Large parts of yoga, though, and this is the same with the martial arts, the highest of the martial arts, were often infused with a Zen understanding of non-action and spontaneity and no-mindedness in the midst of fighting. A large part of the yogic tradition, the lower part, so to speak, was basically egoic fear and control over natural processes. So the idea there is that if you're totally enlightened, that you totally can control samsara. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense at that point.
You know, when I used to teach in Bodh Gaya, almost without exception, all the Tibetans we spoke to were convinced that if someone was fully enlightened, that not only were they omnipotent and omniscient, but also were incapable of suffering on any level, including physical. It was, if someone was truly enlightened, they would literally be incapable of it.
That's a blue meme version of Buddhism.
Yeah, there was a lot of it out there, yep. Also in the tradition. And I remember when I was in Nepal on a bus going up to see this fantastic Chacho Rinpoche. Chacho Rinpoche is supposed to be a living Buddha, because he's supposed to have attained Buddhahood in this life. He didn't inherit it. so he's very respected. He spent 30 years in silent retreat,
yeah,
in the Himalayas. So he's quite an extraordinary, very impressive. He's like a real lion. But
but
I remember this American translator nun who was in the bus. She said, "Oh yes, All the lamas, you know, can walk through walls whenever they want." And she wasn't a young woman, and she didn't blink an eye when she said it.
There's a strange kind of mixture between the old ideals of the merely ascending path of nirvikalpa and nirvana and the tantric ideals of the non-dual. The classic drive in both the Patanjali Sutras and the Theravadin tradition really is to get into that unmanifest cessation. And in that state, you can feel no pain. There literally is no pain. It's, again, very similar to the state of deep dreamless sleep that people are plunged into each night. There's no pain, there's no ego, there's no suffering, and so on. That is the nirvanic state. That's very similar to the nirvanic state. And if you can do that consciously, you can do just what some of the monks in Vietnam did.
Yeah.
You pour gasoline on yourself, light yourself on fire, and not blink once. That's nirvikalpa. That's not non-dual.
Right.
The unfortunate part about non-dual realization is you don't become less sensitive to suffering, but more.
More.
Because you cannot escape into nirvikalpa. You are ensconced as the witness under all conditions, and therefore you notice everything arising moment to moment, and that means pain and suffering and hurt and so on. And if anything, you can feel it more intensely because there are no filters. There's no egoic protection. There's no way to say, okay, time off, where's the morphine? So that part is paradoxical as well, because the pain arises in a sea of ecstasy, but the pain doesn't go away. And that's what's so also paradoxical about the situation. But the notion of full enlightenment, meaning that you can egoically boss your cells around, doesn't quite work, I don't think.
But you know, in the Aurobindo tradition, they seem to be speaking quite a lot about that stuff.
Well, look, obviously there are yogic powers where you can slow your heart and your respiration and so on.
That's not what they're talking about. They're talking about, quote-unquote, enlightening the self.
No, I know that. Okay. The real descent of the supermind is a transfiguration into a bodily being of light.
Yeah.
Frankly, I don't think, how should I put this, I think that's a preliminary vision of the stage of incarnational non-duality that is just emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 100 years from now, 1,000 years from now, it'll have a completely different form. You know what? We might be existing inside fiber optics, our entire consciousness, completely luminous digital bits scattered through all eternity. We don't know what it's going to look like. I think that was just their enlightened vision of what a rupakaya transformed by and infused by Dharmakaya would look like. But I think it's just one possibility, and I think we're going to have a much better understanding as the decades and centuries unfold. I'm not sure it's going to be exactly like Aurobindo thought, but it might be. I'm just saying it's going to be interesting to see what actually unfolds in the world of form.
So following on from that, one thing, you know, as we're looking into this question that I found kind of interesting, it seems that often when spiritually passionate, inspired men and women get bitten by the bug of evolution. In other words, when the passion for enlightenment meets the passion for evolution, more often than not, there seems to be a tendency to become, shall we say, excessively fascinated with the material implications of evolutionary potential.
Yeah.
And I think the example we were just speaking about, you know, even with the master himself, I kept getting that sense about, you know, why is there so much of an emphasis and concern with this dimension of it? I mean, I can understand it being, you know, being present to some degree, but it almost suddenly became too important.
That's one of the downsides of the non-dual evolutionary incarnational approach.
Right.
And we were talking about these sort of two impulses that men and women have, ascending and descending, the descending towards sort of pagan immersion in nature and so on, and the ascending towards a sort of formless transcendental realm. And what happens often is that people will come out of a transcendental orientation and get a hit of this non-dual, all-embracing reality, and then they sort of ricochet in the opposite direction, and they, in a sense, become evolutionary pagans. In other words, they give so much emphasis to the world of form and its unfolding nature that they constantly forget the ever-present witness and the ever-present emptiness of which all arising forms are but mere manifestations and modifications.
Yeah, or even if they don't lose touch with it, there often seems to be an over or excessive concern with materializing the divine, you know, but literally taking that maybe too literally.
It is too literal because of the idea. I mean, Shankara also dealt with a lot of these issues in a beautiful way when he was talking about how realization itself cannot be the result of a series of actions, because that would make realization itself temporal and not ever-present.
Right.
And that's correct. What we're saying with development or transformation or evolution is enlightenment still remains in some way an ultimate mystery and an accident.
Absolutely.
But development makes you accident prone. And that's what we're basically trying to do. You can fall off of your own game at any point and have a direct realization of ever-present emptiness. But you're more likely to do that the more highly evolved you are, number one. Number two, whenever you have your realization, you will express it more fully the more highly evolved you are. And in any event, it gives you a more complete and kind of combined realization when you're trying to pay attention to both sides of that equation. Because even a perfect realization has to manifest itself in the manifest realm.
Absolutely.
And if you can't read and write, you're going to be limited in how many people you can express this to.
Right.
And if you can't speak well, you're going to be limited in how many people you can express your realization to. If you're poorly developed in the interpersonal line of development or the emotional line of development or the cognitive line of development, you're going to be crippled in your obligation to express your realization. So, of course, you want to try to improve the vehicle, both because it's a more adequate expression of spirit and you're more likely to discover spirit the
right.
more you do that.
Right. So you agree that there's this danger when the enlightened mind gets bitten by the evolutionary surge to get excessively fascinated with the material.
It becomes kind of a fetish.
Yeah, right.
I mean, which is fine. You're supposed to be erotically involved with everything that's arising moment to moment. I mean, it's a blissful erotic union. But when the scales get a little bit too in favor of either Shiva or Shakti,
right.
you're in trouble.
Right, right, exactly. And the last one was following on from this. It's really, really part of the same issue. There are a lot of people in different schools of individuals that are very fired up about evolution these days, and it's great, you know. I mean,
yeah.
Because a lot of the folks that are really into and inspired by and passionate about evolutionist need are often very inspired and really do care in many ways that often a lot of people that are merely into the non-dual traditions, often they're much more just interested in their own liberation and often aren't really quite as inspired or as compassionate or interested in life as often some of the evolutionary people are, even though often the people that are interested in evolution aren't that interested in enlightenment.
Yep.
But in this distinction, I've noticed, again, and it's not black and white, but often the people that are very on fire with evolution and very inspired by it don't seem to, shall we say, either have not experienced or are not aware of what I would call the sacred. In other words, that which
yeah.
brings one to one's knees.
Yeah.
And another interesting distinction here, because I know, and I'm just repeating what I just said, that often people that are aware of this sacred dimension are oblivious to and aren't interested in the evolutionary implications of spiritual transformations,
right.
and often the individual who are passionately on fire with the evolutionary implications of human transformation are not aware of or in touch with the demand of the sacred for the ego to submit.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And it is a variation on the theme that we've been developing. Again, it's a simplistic notion, but there's samsara, there's nirvana, and there's their non-duality. And sometimes, ironically, people that have, shall we say, a fine, keen, accurate understanding of samsara and are nobly motivated within samsara can do better for the world than those who are merely looking at nirvana, even though in some sense that might be a higher estate. And it's sort of strange to
yeah.
see people that aren't in touch with the sacred doing really good work in the world, and some people who profess to be in touch with the sacred are basically ignoring, denouncing, or renouncing the world, and thereby increasing the suffering in the world.
Exactly.
Very, very odd.
Amen.
So obviously, again, what we want to try to do with any sort of non-dual or integral approach is to say, look, you know, keep up this fantastic work on the evolutionary side, but see it arising within the context of the sacred.
Exactly.
And that's a very important
exactly.
task. There was an attempt to do that, not very clean on both sides, I have to say, but there is at least a kind of historical precedent in the recent West with a Christian church developing liberation theology.
Mm.
And that was in their own, you know, I don't think, again, either sides of the equation were that strongly understood. There are some real exceptions in the Catholic Church, some highly realized beings, but it was their attempt to take basically the teachings of heaven or transcendental realm and unite them with the teachings of earth or the manifest realm and work for the liberation of people economically and not just spiritually. So it tended to be kind of a union of Jesus and Marx in an interesting way.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's okay. That's a move in the right direction.
Absolutely.
Because it's trying to integrate samsara and nirvana using more up-to-date tools. And we've learned a lot about social dynamic, political processes, how to create economic wealth, how to alleviate suffering with medicine and dentistry and so on. And not to use those to alleviate suffering is a profound abdication of the bodhisattva and tantric vows. So, again, it's bringing these two together that seems to hold the brightest promise for both.
Absolutely. So we did it.
All right.
It was good.
Well, like I say, we should just do this more often, and it will be a department in your magazine.
Oh, fantastic, Ken.
You are listening to www.integralnaked.org.